the White House now, where I think veteran correspondent Frank Sesno could tell us a little bit about self-censorship, that inertial guidance system's always going on, isn't it? Is there any formal censorship there?
Well, there's no self-censorship, Reed. If somebody tells me something, I'm going to pass it on, unless there's a particular and compelling reason not to. I can't deny that I wouldn't like to have access to the Oval Office and all the same maps and charts and graphs that the president's looking at, but that's not possible, it's not realistic, and it's probably not even desirable.
Well, how are you?
I'm fine.
Can I sit down there, please?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Welcome to Holland. I'll introduce you first in a few lines. Professor Chomsky, Noam Chomsky, is nu zes en is ongeveer de meest controversiële intellectueel van Amerika. Dat is ook alweer een platitude, maar zo wordt hij nu eenmaal altijd genoemd.
Chomsky has been called the Einstein of modern linguistics. The New York Times has said he's arguably the most important intellectual alive today. But his presence here has sparked a protest.
This book that has poisoned the world, an old liar in there. And as a Vietnamese people, we come here to burn the book.
Vietnam! Vietnam!
He said that in Vietnam there's no violation of human rights and no crime in Cambodia. He's wrong.
Chomsky is using, he's a professor, he's using that to poison the world. And we come here to protest that.
I don't mind the denunciations, frankly. I mind the lies. Well, I mean, intellectuals are very good at lying. They're professionals at it. You know, vilification is a wonderful technique. There's no way of responding to it. If somebody calls you, an anti-Semite, what can you say? I'm not an anti-Semite. Or, you know, somebody says you're a racist, you're a Nazi or something. You always lose. I mean, the person who throws the mud always wins.
Yeah.
Because there's no way of responding to such charges.
Professor Chomsky seems to believe that the people he criticizes fall into one of two classes, liars or dupes. Consider what happens when I discuss the case of Robert Faurisson. Let me recall the facts.
Let's not go into details, please, because
the details happen to be important.
Yes, but I have only one question on the Faurisson question.
Do the facts matter or don't they matter?
Of course they do.
I don't care what the facts are.
Faurisson says that the massacre of the Jews in the Holocaust is a historic lie. No.
Now this is an important one. It has a lot to do with the topic.
Your views are extremely controversial, and perhaps one of the things that has been most controversial and that you've been most strongly criticized for was your defense of a French intellectual who was suspended from his university post for contending that there were no Nazi death camps in World War II.
My name is Robert Faurisson. I am 60. I am university professor in Lyon, France. Behind me, you may see the courthouse of Paris, the Palais de Justice. In this place, I was convicted many times at the beginning of the 80s. I was charged by 9 associations, mostly Jewish associations, for inciting hatred. Racial hatred, for racial defamation, for damage by falsifying a story.
Professor Chomsky and a number of other intellectuals signed a petition in which Faurisson is called a respected professor of literature who merely tried to make his findings public.
Perhaps we can start with just the story of Robert Faurisson and your involvement.
More than 500 people signed, maybe 600, mostly universitaires, scholars.
And what happened to the other 499 of them? How come we only hear about Chomsky's signature?
Well, I think it's because Chomsky is in himself a kind of political power.
I signed a petition calling on the tribunal to defend his civil rights. At that point, the French press, which apparently has no conception of freedom of speech, concluded that since I had called for his civil rights, I was therefore defending his theses.
Faurisson then published a book in which he tried to prove that the Nazi gas chambers never existed.
What we deny is that there was
an extermination program and an extermination, actually, especially in gas chambers or gas dams.
The book contains a preface written by Professor Chomsky in which he calls Faurisson a relatively apolitical sort of liberal.
A communist is a man, a Jew is a man, a Nazi is a man, I am a man.
Are you a Nazi?
I am not a Nazi.
How would you describe yourself politically?
Nothing.
The preface that you wrote,
That's not the preface that I wrote, because I never wrote a preface. You know that I never wrote a preface. He's referring to a statement of mine on civil liberties, which was added to a book in which Faurisson, excuse me. Yes, I
and
used
the language you use has meaning.
That's right.
And
the, language I use.
A political liberal, or as someone whose views can be dignified by the words findings or conclusions, that is a judgment, and that is a favorable judgment of his views.
On the contrary.
Can I continue with the fact?
Yes, you can continue with the facts for hours, but
there are a few
facts that,
Let's get to the so-called preface.
Huh?
I was then asked by the person who organized the petition to write a statement on freedom of speech, just banal comments about freedom of speech, pointing out the difference between defending a person's right to express his views and defending the views expressed. So I did that. I wrote a rather banal statement called Some Elementary Remarks on Freedom of Expression, and I told him, do what you like with it.
So Pierre produced a book which all the arguments of Faurisson were to be put in front of the court. And we thought wise to use the text of Noam Chomsky as a kind of warning, a foreword, to say that it was a matter of freedom of expression, freedom of thought, freedom of research.
Why did you try at the last moment to get it back from
that's
the book?
That's the one thing I'm sorry about.
But that's the real, that's the real important thing.
It's not.
Because
I tried to retract it.
Because with that you said it was wrong of you.
No, I didn't. See, in fact, take a look at what I wrote a letter, which we then publicized, in which I said, look, things have reached the point where the French intellectual community simply is incapable of understanding the issues. At this point, it's just going to confuse matters even more if my comments on freedom of speech happen to be attached to this book, which I didn't know existed. So just to clarify things, you better separate them. Now, in retrospect, I think I probably shouldn't have done that. I should have just said, fine, then let it appear, because it ought to appear. But that's, apart from that, I regard this as not only trivial, but as compared with other positions I've taken on freedom of speech, invisible.
I do not think that the state ought to have the right to determine historical truth and to punish people who deviate from it. I'm not willing to give the state that right, even if they happen to
deny that the gas chambers ever existed.
But I'm saying, if you believe in freedom of speech, you believe in freedom of speech for views you don't like. I mean, Goebbels was in favor of freedom of speech for views he liked, right? So was Stalin. If you're in favor of freedom of speech, that means you're in favor of freedom of speech precisely for views you despise. Otherwise, you're not in favor of freedom of speech. There's two positions you can have on freedom of speech, and you can decide which position you want. With regard to my defense of the utterly offensive, the people who express utterly offensive views, I haven't the slightest doubt that every commissar says, you're defending that person's views. No, I'm not. I'm defending his right to express them. The difference is crucial, and the difference has been understood outside of fascist circles since the 18th century.
Is there anything like objectivity, scientific objectivity, reality? As a scientist,
Look, I'm not saying I defend the views. If somebody publishes a scientific article, which I disagree with, I do not say the state ought to put him in jail.
All right, but you don't have to support him right away and say, him just for the sake of everybody saying that whatever
he
wants.
Suppose this guy is taken to court and charged with falsification. Then I'm going to defend him, even if I disagree.
But he wasn't taken to court.
Oh, you're wrong.
But when did you write the support?
He was brought to court. And in fact, the only support that I gave him is to say he has a right of freedom of speech, period.
There is no doubt in my mind that the example that I gave about this story with the Holocaust did not exist is very, very typical.
How much of the American press believes that Faurisson has anything to say, or any press?
How much of the press in France?
Since I followed
What percentage
suicide,
would you say?
I'll tell you.
Is it higher than zero?
I'll tell you.
Have you ever seen anything in any newspaper or any journal saying that this man is anything other than a lunatic?
I'll try to answer. I think that I just followed the
That's
case.
That's a simple question.
I followed the case 5 or 6 years ago, and I happened to see that Noam Chomsky was in for strong criticism, even from some of his supporters, for doing something which could be interpreted only in terms of a campaign against Israel.
Going back years, I am absolutely certain that I've taken far more extreme positions on people who deny the Holocaust than you have. For example, you go back to my earliest articles and you will find that I say that even to enter into the arena of debate on the question of whether the Nazis carried out such atrocities is already to lose one's humanity. So I don't even think you ought to discuss the issue if you want to know my opinion. But if anybody wants to refute Faurisson, there's certainly no difficulty in doing so.
I'm not interested in freedom of speech and all that. I have to win, and that's the question. And I shall win.
I'm just an ordinary mom who just thinks in terms of, I don't want to someday be holding my grandchildren and watching something horrible happen and feel like I didn't do anything. And I mean, it's obvious what you're doing. And my question is, on a practical level, where do you see the most practical place to put your energy? I mean, tonight I feel an overwhelm, like I feel like it's too big, it's too much to even make a dent in.
The way things change is because lots of people are working all the time. And, you know, they're working in their communities, in their workplace, or wherever they happen to be, and they're building up the basis for popular movements which are going to make changes. That's the way everything has ever happened in history, you know, whether it was the end of slavery or whether it was the democratic revolutions or anything you want, you name it, that's the way it worked. You get a very false picture of this from the history books. In the history books, there's a couple of leaders, you know, George Washington or Martin Luther King or whatever. And I don't want to say that those people are unimportant, like Martin Luther King was certainly important, but he was not the civil rights movement. Martin Luther King can appear in the history books because lots of people whose names you will never know and whose names are all forgotten and who may have been killed and so on were working down in the South. When you have activists and people concerned and people devoting themselves and dedicating themselves to social change or issues or whatever, then people like me can appear, and we can appear to be prominent, but that's only because somebody else is doing the work. My work, whether it's giving hundreds of talks a year or spending 20 hours a week writing letters or writing books, is not directed to intellectuals and politicians. It's directed to what are called ordinary people.
Yeah.
And what I expect from them is, in fact, exactly what they are, that they should try to understand the world and act in accordance with their decent impulses, and that they should try to improve the world. And many people are willing to do that, but they have to understand. And in fact, as far as I can see, in these things, I feel that I'm simply helping people develop courses of intellectual self-defense.
What did you mean by that?
What would such a course be?
I don't mean go to school, because I'm not going to get it there. It means you have to develop an independent mind and work on it. Now, that's extremely hard to do alone. You know, the beauty of our system is it isolates everybody. Each person is sitting alone in front of the tube. You know, it's very hard to have ideas or thoughts under those circumstances. You can't fight the world alone. Some people can, but it's pretty rare. The way to do it is through organization. So courses of intellect. intellectual self-defense will have to be in the context of political and other organization. And it makes sense, I think, to look at what the institutions are trying to do and to take that almost as a key. What they're trying to do is what we're trying to combat. If they're trying to keep people isolated and separate and, and so on, well, we're trying to do the opposite. We're trying to bring them together. So in your local community, you want to have sources of alternative action. People with parallel concerns, maybe differently focused, but at the core, sort of similar values and a similar interest in helping people learn how to defend themselves against external power and taking control of their lives and, you know, reaching out your hand to people who need it. That's a common array of concerns. You can learn about your own values and you can figure out how to defend yourself and so on in conjunction with others.
Are there one or two publications that I, as an average person, a biologist, can read to bypass this filter of our press?
Now, if you ask what media can I turn to get the right answers, first of all, I wouldn't tell you that because I don't think there's an answer. The right answers are what you decide are the right answers. Maybe everything I'm telling is wrong. Okay, could perfectly well be, I'm the God. But that's something for you to figure out. I mean, I could tell you what I think happens to be more or less right, but there isn't any reason why you should pay any attention to it.
What impact do you feel alternative media is currently having or could potentially have? I'm actually a little more interested in its potential. And just to define my terms, by alternative media, I'm referring to media that are or could be citizen-controlled as opposed to state or corporate-controlled.
You know, that's what's kept people together. To the extent that people are able to do something constructive, it's because they have some way of interacting.
I mean, I've always felt it would be a very positive thing and it should be pushed as far as it can go. I think it's going to have a very hard time. There's just such a concentration of resources and power that alternative media, while extremely important, are going to have quite a battle. It's true there are things which are small successes, but it's because people have just been willing to put in incredible effort. Like, say, take Z Magazine. I mean, that's a national magazine which literally has a staff of two and no resources.
Tell us a little about Z Magazine, what it is and what makes it different.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Thank you.
We just wanted to do a magazine that would address all the sides of political life, economics, race, gender, authority, political relations. And we wanted to do it in a way that would incorporate an attention to how to not only understand what's going on, but how to make things better, what to aim toward, and to provide at the same time humor, culture, a kind of a magazine that people could relate to and could get a lot out of and could participate in.
And what we wanted to do, which we didn't think was provided by the existing magazines, was to give it a real activist slant so that it could be very useful to the variety of movements in the country. And we just felt there wasn't a magazine that reflected that, that inspired people and that gave people sort of a strategy and perhaps even a vision of how things could be better.
South End Press has sort of made it. That is, they're surviving. It's a small collective, again, with no resources, and they put out a lot of books, including quite a lot of good books. But for a South End book to get reviewed is almost impossible.
Editorially and business-wise, we make decisions based on a politics that no corporate publisher can really advocate because of their ties to corporate America. We can solicit manuscripts based on what we feel is the relevance for the movement, and we can make our business decisions based on whether we feel people can afford our books, whether we feel that a book might not make that much money, but it needs to be out there, and maybe there's 1,000 people who would buy it. And those are criteria that we feel are very precious in this day of corporate mergers.
Well, and likewise, our structure about sharing work and continuing our training process as long as we're at the press, there are losses there in terms of productivity, but in terms of empowerment, all of us are then able to say, my perspective is different from yours, then all of our intelligence gets used in making those decisions and not just whoever happens to have done it the longest, whoever happens to have graduated from the best schools in order to be the best editor, making all the decisions and only using his or her intelligence.
The listener-supported radio in the United States has undergone a remarkable growth in the last decade. It's perhaps the fastest growing alternative media. There are many reasons for this. First and foremost is that it's enormously economical, and it reaches communities that have not been served by community radio before. And in Boulder particular, we see with someone like Noam Chomsky, who's been there, I believe, three times in the last 6 years, he has a tremendous audience, and KGNU is partly responsible for that, because we play his tapes on a regular basis, we play his lectures and his interviews, so when he does come to Boulder and people hear what he has to say, they're able to tune in. It's not something exotic or esoteric that he's talking about, it's material that they're very familiar with, and he's noted this, incidentally.
And if there's a listener-supported radio station, that means that people can get
daily, every day, a different way of looking at the world, not just what the corporate media want you to see, but a different picture, a different understanding. Not only can you hear it, but you can participate in it. You can add your own thoughts, you know, and you can learn something and so on. Well, that's the way people become human, you know. That's the way you become human participants in a social and political system.
Hello, I'm Ed Robinson, and this is Non-Corporate News. What is Non-Corporate News, and why is it necessary?
I didn't want to just show another film at a library or something. I wanted to make my own statement. I thought it would be more fun to do, and perhaps I could get other people involved in a project besides showing a film. We could make a film or a video. The local cable stations hooked up to three communities, Lynn, Swampscott, and Salem. So that's 30,000 people, or 30,000 homes, I'm not sure, but I'm sure a lot of people will see it, and they'll be the kind of people who don't go out to see a film. It'll go right into their houses, so if they're flipping through the channels, they might be able to get a completely new idea of the world.
So there's kind of networks of cooperation developed. Which, I mean, like here, for example, is a collection of stuff from a friend of mine in Los Angeles who does careful monitoring of the whole press in Los Angeles and a lot of the British press, which he reads, and does selection, so I don't have to read the movie reviews and the local gossip and all this kind of stuff, but I get the occasional nugget that sneaks through, and that you find if you're carefully and intelligently and critically reviewing a wide range of press. Well, there are a fair number of people who do this, and we exchange information.
We wrote this two-volume work in which we saw one another for a couple of weeks when we were getting started, but then we wrote two volumes essentially without seeing one another, just by phone, by mail, and exchanging manuscripts. But this takes a lot of communication by mail. My Chomsky file is a couple of feet thick.
The end result is that you do have access to resources in a way which I doubt that any national intelligence agency can duplicate, a little on scholarship. So there are ways of compensating for the absence of resources. People can do things. Like, for example, I found out about the arms flow to Iran by reading transcripts of the BBC. And by reading an interview somewhere with an Israeli ambassador in one city and reading something else in the Israeli press. Now, okay, the information is there, but it's there to a fanatic, you know, somebody who wants to spend a substantial part of their time and energy exploring it and comparing today's lies with yesterday's leaks and so on. That's a research job. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it just simply doesn't make any sense to ask the general population to dedicate themselves to this task on every issue. I'm not given to false modesty. There are things that I can do, and I know that I can do them reasonably well, including analysis and study, research. I mean, I know how to do that sort of thing, and I think I have a reasonable understanding of the way the world works as much as anyone can.
Yeah.
And that turns out to be a very useful resource for people who are doing active organizing, trying to to engage themselves in a way which will make it a little bit of a better world. And if you can help in those things or participate in them, well, that's, you know, that's rewarding.
I wonder if you can envision a time when people like myself, again, the naive people of this world, can again take pride in the United States. And is that even a healthy wish now? Because it may be this hunger for pride in our country that makes us more easily manipulated by the powers that you talk about.
I think you first of all have to ask what you mean by your country. Now, if you mean by the country, the government, I don't think you can be proud of it, and I don't think you could ever be proud of it. Or you couldn't be proud of any government. It's not our government. You know. And you shouldn't be. States are violent institutions. The government of any country, including ours, represents some sort of domestic power structure, and it's usually violent. States are violent to the extent that they're powerful. That's roughly accurate. You look at American history, it's nothing to write home about. You know, why are we here? We're here because, say, some 10 million Native Americans were wiped out. That's not very pretty. Until the 1960s, it was still cowboys and Indians. In the 1970s, for the first time, really, it became possible even for scholarship to try to deal with the facts as they were. For example, to deal with the fact that the Native American population was far higher than had been claimed, millions higher, maybe as many as 10 million higher than had been claimed, and that they had an advanced civilization, and that there was something akin to genocide that took place. Now, we went through 200 years of our history without facing that fact. One of the effects of the 1960s is it's possible to at least begin to come to think about the facts. Well, that's an advance.
Do you think that this activism 20 years ago has made a difference in how our society operates now?
It has not changed the institutions and the way they function. But it has led to very significant cultural changes. Now, remember, these movements of the 60s expanded in the 70s and expanded further in the 80s, and they reached into other parts of the society and different issues. A lot of things that seemed outrageous in the 60s are taken for granted today. So, for example, take the feminist movement, for example, which barely began to exist in the 60s. Now it's part of general consciousness and awareness. The ecological movements began in the 70s. The solidarity, third world solidarity movements were very limited in the 60s. It was really Vietnam. And in the 60s also, it was a student movement, as you say. Now it's not. Now it's mainstream America.
If there is more dissidence now than you can remember, why do you go on to write that the people feel isolated?
Because I think much of the general population recognizes that the organized institutions do not reflect their concerns and interests and needs. They do not feel that they participate meaningfully in the political system. They do not feel that the media are telling them the truth or even reflect their concerns. They go outside of the organized institutions to act.
We see more and more of our elected leaders and know less and less of what they're doing.
Yeah.
This medium does that.
Very striking. In fact, the presidential elections have been almost removed from the point where the public even takes them seriously as involving a matter of choice.
So what do you think about what goes on in the White House?
It's kept too private, I think.
Yeah, they should come out.
I know.
People.
Yeah.
Who should talk to the people?
George Bush.
Well, it means that the political system increasingly functions without public input. It means to an increasing extent, not only do people not ratify decisions presented to them, but they don't even take the trouble of ratifying them. They assume that the decisions are going on independently of what they may do in the polling booth.
Ratification would be what?
Well, ratification would mean a system in which there are two positions presented to me, the voter. I go into the polling booth and I push one or another button depending on which of those positions I want. That's a very limited form of democracy. Really meaningful democracy would mean that I play a role in forming those decisions and in creating those positions. And that would be real democracy.
That's not
we're
that.
Very far from that. But we're even departing from the point where there is ratification. When you have stage-managed elections, with the public relations industry determining what words come out of people's mouth, candidates decide what to say on the basis of tests that determine what the effect will be across the population. Somehow people don't see how profoundly contemptuous that is of democracy.
is near, but first, the swearing-in of Dan Quayle.
Please move to your seats.
For the first time in this century, for the first time in perhaps all history, man does not have to invent a system by which to live.
We don't have to talk late into the night about which form of government is better. We don't have to wrest justice from the king. We only have to summon it from within. This is the time that future leads the door you could walk right through into a room called tomorrow. Great nations in the world are moving toward democracy through the door of freedom.
Referring back to your earlier comment about escaping from or doing away with capitalism, I was wondering what scheme, workable scheme, you would put in its place.
Me?
Or
well, what I would,
suggest to others who might be in a position to set it up and get it going.
Well, I mean, I think that what used to be called centuries ago wage slavery is intolerable. I mean, I don't think people ought to be forced to rent themselves in order to survive. I think that the economic institutions ought to be run democratically by their participants, by the communities in which they exist, and so on. And I think basically through various kinds of free association.
Historically, have there been any sustained examples on any substantial scale of societies which approximated to the anarchist ideal?
There are small societies, small in number, that have, I think, done so quite well, and there are a few examples of large-scale libertarian revolutions which were largely anarchist in their structure. As to the first, small societies extending over a long period, I myself think the most dramatic example is perhaps the Israeli kibbutzim, which for a long period, may or may not be true today, really were constructed on anarchist principles, that is, of direct worker control, integration of agriculture, industry, service, personal life on an egalitarian basis with direct and, in fact, quite active participation in self-management, and were, I should think, extraordinarily successful. A good example of a really large-scale anarchist revolution, or largely anarchist revolution, in fact, the best example, to my knowledge, is the Spanish Revolution in 1936. And, in fact, you can't tell what would have happened. That anarchist revolution was simply destroyed by force, but during the period in which it was alive, I think it was inspiring testimony to the ability of poor working people to organize, manage their affairs extremely successfully without coercion and control.
How far does the success of libertarian socialism or anarchism as a way of life really depend on a fundamental change in the nature of man, both in his motivation, his altruism, and also in his knowledge and sophistication?
I think it not only depends on it, but in fact, the whole purpose of libertarian socialism is that it will contribute to it. It will contribute to a spiritual transformation, precisely that kind of great transformation in the way humans conceive of themselves and their ability to act, to
to decide, to create, to produce, to inquire, precisely that spiritual transformation that social thinkers from the left Marxist tradition, from Luxembourg, say, on over through anarcho-syndicalists have always emphasized. So on the one hand, it requires that spiritual transformation. On the other hand, its purpose is to create institutions which will contribute to that transformation.
You've written that in looking at contributions of gifted thinkers, one must make sure to understand their contributions, but also to eliminate the errors in them. And of your ideas, what would you guess would be discarded and what would be assimilated by future thinkers?
Well, I mean, I would assume virtually everything would be discarded. For example, here we have to distinguish. I mean, the work that I do in my professional area, I mean, if I still believed what I believed 10 years ago, I'd assume the field is dead. So I assume that when next time you read a student's paper, you're going to see something that has to be changed and you continue to make progress. In dealing with social and political issues, in my view, what is at all understood is pretty straightforward. I don't think that there may be deep and complicated things, but if so, they're not understood. The basic ways, to the extent that we understand society at all, it's pretty straightforward. And I don't think that those simple understandings are likely to undergo much change.
The point is that you have to work. And that's why the propaganda system is so successful. Very few people are going to have the time or the energy or the commitment to carry out the constant battle that's required to get outside of, McNeil Lear or Dan Rather or somebody like that. The easy thing to do, you come home from work, you're tired, you've had a busy day, not going to spend the evening carrying out a research project. So you turn on the tube and say, it's probably right. Or you look at the headlines in the paper and then you watch the sports or something. Because that's basically the way the system of indoctrination works. Sure, the other stuff is there, but you're going to have to work to find it.
Modern industrial civilization has developed within a certain system of convenient myths. The driving force of modern industrial civilization has been individual material gain, which is accepted as legitimate, even praiseworthy, on the grounds that private vices yield public benefits in the classic formulation. Now, it's long been understood very well that a society that is based on this principle will destroy itself in time. It can only persist with whatever suffering and injustice it entails as long as it's possible to pretend that the destructive forces that humans create are limited, that the world is an infinite resource, and that the world is an infinite garbage can. At this stage of history, either one of two things is possible. Either the general population will take control of its own destiny and will concern itself with community interests, guided by values of solidarity and sympathy and concern for others, or alternatively, there will be no destiny for anyone to control. As long as some specialized class is in a position of authority, it is going to set policy in the special interests that it serves. But the conditions of survival, let alone justice, require rational social planning in the interests of the community as a whole, and by now that means the global community. The question is whether privileged elites should dominate mass communication and should use this power as they tell us they must, namely to impose necessary illusions, to manipulate and deceive the stupid majority and remove them from the public arena. The question, in brief, is whether democracy and freedom are values to be preserved or threats to be avoided. In this possibly terminal phase of human existence, democracy and freedom are more than values to be treasured. They may well be essential to survival. Thank you.
He's up there thinking for himself, and he's deciphering this tremendously overweighted body of information, which he puts into an order and gives you the feeling that you can do the same thing, that the whole thing is decipherable. And he also gives you the sense that there is a source, there's a center to to the to a dissenting population, although we feel that there's no center. And I think that is what reactivated in me a desire to get back, get reacquainted with the political scene after 30 years of alienation from it.
You do hundreds of interviews and lectures, and you're dealing with massacres in East Timor and invasions of Panama, etc. Pretty horrific stuff, death squads. What keeps you going? I mean, don't you get burned out on this material?
It's mainly a matter of whether you can look yourself in the mirror, I think.
Hop, gotta go. Get these before it's out.
Okay. Maybe you can say all the word for us.
Okay.
There's a train that comes somewhere down the track. And you can keep on waiting where they're sleeping. And this train has been running since the time we meet. And it's running on the low, but it will remain all aboard.
Let's see it. This is the microphone.
It's about 1 hour later for me too.
Oh yes, no, that's true. Yeah. I don't believe it.
Sorry, I'm making you answer that.
It took
so short.
Did we hit it in 2 minutes?
Well, we did pretty well, actually. That means less sports, and that's fine with me.
People out there, they don't know what's going on. If the people knew what you say here today, there'd be a change. Thank you.
On that optimistic note, Professor Chomsky, thank you very much indeed.
How did it go?
Oh, I thought it was sort of technical sounding. But there wasn't much of a rhythm there.
Did you ever think of running for president?
If I ran for president, first thing I do is tell people not to vote for me.
This guy's got it.
Still,
he really does.
Yeah. And people still believe that the Celtics lost to the World Champions.
Thanks.
Get on board.
Get on.
I got freedom chain. On board. Get on. I got freedom chain. On board. You better get on board. Team of love.